The headlines: Iran says foreign promoters of violence are encouraging terrorism by keeping Maman criminal attacks targeting Iran. The Israeli regime targets areas in central and coastal parts of Syria with deadly airstrikes. And Moscow accuses Kiev of committing war crimes by executing more than 10 Russian soldiers after they surrender. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisu Mishahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign ministry has criticized international silence on the recent terror attacks in Iran. The ministry says the world has remained silent while, from the perspective of international norms, terrorism is condemned in any form, time and place. The ministry says the silence of, quote, claimants of human rights and foreign promoters of chaos and violence in Iran sends a message that they also promote terrorism across the world. The ministry called on international bodies to prevent the creation of a safe haven for violence seekers by condemning the latest attacks on Iran. Those attacks left 14 security forces dead in several cities since Wednesday. Last month, over a dozen people were also killed in the city of Shiraz, south of Iran. Tehran says terrorists have taken advantage of the recent wave of foreign-backed rioting in Iran. A terrorist attack in the city of Yizeh, Iran's southwestern province of Khuzestan, has claimed the lives of several people. Mourners from all over the province attended the funeral procession, calling on authorities to bring the perpetrators to justice. Mehdi Abbasian reports.
An incident that caused Iranians a great deal of agony. Iranian mourners took part in the funeral procession of the victims of the terror attack in the city of Yizeh in floods of tears. In addition to expressing their deepest sympathy with families of the victims, the participants also voiced their support for the Islamic Republic amid the enemy's efforts to destabilize the country.
We have taken part in this funeral procession to send a message to the U.S. and Israel. They must know that Iran is not alone. We support the leader of the Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation. They cannot sow division in Iran by killing civilians. We will be victorious.
My fellow countrymen and dear people of Yizeh, be sure that the Islamic Republic is strong and will definitely take revenge for the blood that has been shed by all the cruel enemies who are servants of the criminal government of the United States.
Also, a number of high-ranking state and military officials attended the funeral, vowing to bring the perpetrators of this crime to justice as soon as possible.
The perpetrators of this crime will be punished. A number of them have been arrested, while some others have been identified. Some of them attempted to flee the country through border crossings. However, they have been arrested. We will inform the Iranian nation about arresting the rest of the perpetrators in the coming days.
Officials say so far 11 individuals who've been involved in Yizeh terrorist attack have been detained. Seven people, including a 9-year-old child and a woman, were killed, while 11 others were wounded after gunmen started shooting at people in the center of the city.
The terrorist attack was completely pre-planned. The terrorists broke the cameras across the city by shooting at them 24 hours prior to the attack. Then the next day, they opened fire at people at a crossroad from two directions. Their goal was to cause a massive bloodshed.
As they said, the enemies cannot turn Iran to another Syria or Lebanon by carrying out violent acts like the ones in Shahcharagh, Isfahan, and Yizeh.
Iranian officials have strongly condemned the recent terror attacks in the country. They say the enemies of the Islamic Republic have now resorted to armed terror attacks that target civilians because they have failed to advance their anti-Iran agenda through creating media hype. Mahdi Abbasian, Yizeh, Khuzestan.
Iran's Islamic Revolution leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says hegemonic powers would not like the Islamic Republic to make progress. The leader said those powers' problem with Iran is that if the country moves towards forward and makes its presence felt, that it would render the West's liberal democracy logic ineffective across the globe. Ayatollah Khamenei said the West has plundered the whole world for more than two decades with its liberal democracy logic. The leader added that Western states intervened and looted the resources of countries under the pretext of trying to establish democracy. Ayatollah Khamenei said Europe got rich at the expense of many wealthy nations. The leader noted that Iran has nullified the West's liberal democracy logic and has, through real logic, given people identity, awakened them, and made them strong enough to stand up to the Western liberal democracy logic. The Saudi-led war continues to take a heavy humanitarian toll on Yemen, with the country's health ministry saying more than 18 newborn babies are losing their lives every day. The ministry says nearly 40% of Yemeni babies are born prematurely every year, making a drastic increase compared to the pre-war period. Yemeni media say a lack of medical supplies and the use of internationally banned weapons by the Saudi-led coalition are the major reasons for the premature births. Riyadh, along with some of its allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen, coupled with a blockade in 2015 with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime there. Yemen is currently suffering from the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Earlier this week, a Yemeni health official blamed the Saudi war and siege for the spread of disease and infections, including malaria. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Yusuf Mari, explains how the bombardments of the Saudi-led coalition contribute to the causes of premature births.
Most of these premature cases are happening in areas that are susceptible to an increased aerial bombardment by the Saudi-led coalition. And the reason for that, according to the doctors, is because whenever there's airstrikes, whenever Saudi Arabia or the coalition is dropping bombs in these civilian areas, there's, of course, the waste management that's left to be dealt with. And, of course, there's all types of chemicals and hazardous materials such as asbestos that's released and causes cancer, causes premature births, and all types of illnesses and diseases. And this is something that hasn't been managed because there's not enough medical supplies in the country. There is simply not, healthcare is something that's Yemeni people do not have access to because of the blockade and because of the war. The UN, the UN Council, the United Nations, they don't seem to be focusing on the fact that whenever airstrikes land in residential areas, it causes long-term effects such as the premature births that are continuing to happen. According to statistics, there's one out of five children that's born premature in Yemen because of not having access to basic necessities.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Israel has conducted fresh missile attacks on Syria, killing four soldiers and wounding another. The attacks hit several locations in central and coastal areas of Syria. They were carried out from the direction of the Mediterranean coastal city of Benyas in northwestern Syria. Material damage were also caused. The Tel Aviv regime has time and again conducted air attacks on Syrian soil, despite repeated calls by Damascus to stop them. Syria says the attacks are a violation of its sovereignty. It has frequently called on the UN to force the regime to stop the strikes. To discuss that further, we're joined by Barry Grossman, political analyst, joining us live from Bali, Indonesia, and also Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, is joining us live from Manchester. Let's begin with Mr. Grossman. Why, in your opinion, does Israel have impunity, not only as an occupying power over the Golan Heights, but also in the use of military force against Syria?
Well, it's been quite obvious for a very long time that the Atlantic World agenda for the region, and in particular for Palestine, is one and the same as the occupation's agenda for Palestine. And insofar as they work together, both their security apparatus, their intelligence apparatus, and to some extent their political apparatus, of course they run political interference for each other. It's almost political suicide in most Atlantic World countries to say anything critical of the occupation regime in Tel Aviv. And of course, we've seen that over and over again, with the regime actually reaching out and interfering in the domestic political affairs of other nations. The example that comes to mind, of course, is the United Kingdom, where no matter how senior political leaders are, their careers are ended the moment the regime starts spending resources and organizing to denounce those individuals as being anti-Semites, entirely on the basis of their criticism of matters which are connected with Zionism and war crimes and other abuses, rather than anything to do with being Jewish. So it takes a very strong-willed person committed to positions of principle to even dare to voice criticism in the world of politics today. And I think those people are sadly missing. They've learned the hard way, those people who remain in politics, that if there's one subject that's completely out of bounds, it's criticism of the occupation regime and what it does throughout the region and indeed the wider world. And one obvious example is this ongoing bombing by the regime in Syria, which is quite blatantly contrary to international law. They rarely acknowledge it. When they do, they put forward excuses which make no sense and are premised on their claim that their occupation of the Golan Heights is somehow legitimate, when the position in international law is quite the opposite.
So, Mr. Ford, in your opinion, Israel, we see it is firing missiles into Syria, which is a sovereign country. It is using Lebanon's airspace, another sovereign country, to do so. And the UN Security Council is ignoring calls by Syria to react to this type of aggression in a tangible manner. How is this possible?
It's very difficult for Syria to react militarily, because the Israelis cleverly often hide behind civilian aircraft when they're conducting these attacks. And the Israelis would be more than happy if an accident were to occur, and then Syria would be very heavily blamed by the world. Diplomatically, Syria can react by taking its case to the United Nations, and it does this repeatedly, but obviously to no effect because of the way the United Nations are controlled by the US and its NATO allies in terms of any forceful response to Israel's continual breaking of international law. The most that Syria can do is to try to improve its air defenses, and even that is very difficult at the moment with Russia, which has helped in this respect, apparently being obliged to move some of its air defense systems to the Ukraine area. And therefore, we have seen this year alone at least 30 Israeli attacks on Syria. And very little, I'm afraid, that Syria can do about it.
Thank you very much. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria from Manchester, and Barry Grossman, political analyst from Bali, Indonesia. Thank you very much, for both of you gentlemen, for sharing your thoughts and views with us. And thanks to all of you for following this edition of the News Review. Moving on, Russia has accused Ukraine of war crimes over what Moscow calls the execution of several soldiers after they surrendered. The Russian Defense Ministry says nobody can paint the murder of over 10 restrained Russian soldiers as a tragic exception. This comes after footage circulating on social media allegedly showing that the summary of the execution of Russians. The Defense Ministry says the videos are now evidence on the massacre of unarmed Russian prisoners of war. It says that Western backers of Ukraine are turning a blind eye to its military abuses. Meanwhile, Russia's Human Rights Council says it will ask for an international investigation. Earlier this week, a UN report accused both Russia and Ukraine of abusing and torturing prisoners of war. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent Johnny Miller from Donetsk for more details on this execution.
The Ukraine continues to cross the boundaries of what's seen as acceptable by civilized states. While NATO countries continue to say that extremism within Ukraine is Russian propaganda, it's very clear that it's not. Remember, some time ago, a former British soldier who was serving as security for journalists in Libya told me that if it's dark and there's a wounded combatant, you just pop him off, in his words. So these war crimes happen within most armies, but this video and others like it are crossing the boundaries. And they're not only executing these soldiers, but they're also posting these videos online. And these are the kind of images that I'm reminded of in what happened in Syria with ISIS. Of course, ISIS or Daesh, a genocidal terrorist group which would execute soldiers and video it and publish them online. So this won't be the last accusation of war crimes against Ukraine. Almost on a daily basis, certainly on a weekly basis, we have this evidence of Ukrainian war crimes, which is always or usually said to be Russian propaganda. But it's very hard to keep accusing these stories of being Russian propaganda when the Ukrainians are openly flaunting their human rights abuses.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. Why was Imam Khomeini sent into exile? Because a law was ratified by the direct order of the Shah, Muhammad Reza Pahlavi, to the parliament of that day. Imam Khomeini did not tolerate this. He gave a long speech. Because of this speech, he was exiled for 13 years. This was an event that was almost directly related to the Americans. The second event was the killing of students. A number of children who were around your age were massacred in front of Tehran University. They were killed. We can't say the exact number because these sorts of statistics did not exist back then. But a number of them, even one is too many. A number of our dear children were martyred in front of Tehran University. This second event also took place on the 13th of Aban in 1978.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The third event, which took place a year after that incident, after the victory of the revolution, was the students' attack on the American embassy. During that attack, many documents were found that revealed the United States' conspiracies against the Iranian nation. These documents have been published in 70, 80 volumes. You probably don't have the time to read these books, but there was a time when I told the Ministry of Education to include the schemes of these books in school textbooks. Unfortunately, they didn't do it. These documents show what the Americans were doing during the time they were in Iran. That is, from around the years 1949 or 1950, it shows their conspiracies and acts of treason. Well, there is a point to be considered here regarding the attack on the American embassy, which they actually called a spy den, and it really was. In their statements, advertisements, interviews, including the interview they conducted with me during my trip to New York when I was president, the Americans have introduced this event as the beginning of the dispute between the Iranian nation and the United States.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
And a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The people of Somalia continue to endure suffering due to the unending attacks by the Al-Shabaab Takfiri terrorist group. The reign of this Al-Qaeda-linked terror group is making the situation worse for Somali civilians, who are also facing the worst drought in decades. The deadliest attack in recent times occurred in late October in the Somali capital Mogadishu, where at least 100 people were killed. An eyewitness speaks here of what transpired.
I was at the attack area when the first explosion went off. After that, I ran away. I saw many dead people. May Allah have mercy on the dead people and help the injured to recuperate.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on the never-ending terrorist attacks in Somalia. Hundreds have lost their lives this year following attacks by the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab terrorist group. We are asking, why are civilians being killed in terrorist attacks across Somalia while the U.S. regularly claims that its military forces are in the country to battle Al-Shabaab terrorists? The second part of our program is on poverty that is afflicting millions of children across East and Southern Africa amid a devastating drought. We're asking, how is neocolonialism contributing to this unfolding crisis?
Unending terror on Somalia. The Al-Shabaab Takfiri terrorist group killed at least 120 people in twin car bombs at the Education Ministry in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, on the 29th of October. It was the deadliest blast in 5 years in this troubled Horn of African nation. The attack was in response to battlefield gains by government forces supported by clan militias against Al-Shabaab terrorists in the last 3 months.
Speaking at the site of the deadly attack, Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud said the Muslim nation of Somalia is at war with this Al-Qaeda-linked Takfiri terrorist group.
We and the Muslim Somali people are at war with these men. As we speak, fighting is going on in many parts of the country.
Well, for more on these never-ending terrorist attacks in Somalia, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Now, what is the objective of the Al-Shabaab terrorist group in carrying out such a massive attack targeting innocent civilians in Somalia?
You know, different factions within the Al-Shabaab group have different objectives, though the unifying idea is opposition to the Western-backed Somali government, and that's, you know, the purpose of their operations. They want to unite, you know, the Somali majority areas under one, I guess, Al-Shabaab-led government. And really, no one wants to live in an occupied country with foreign armies, starvation and death, and Somalis are no exception. So the United States continues drone strikes, which claim to kill a particular Al-Shabaab leader, and in so doing, keep Somalia in a state of failure, and no stone is left unturned in the effort to keep Somalia from becoming a thriving nation with its sovereignty intact.
This extremist group has been waging a deadly insurgency against Somalia's fragile central government for about 15 years. The president of Somalia says the victims of Al-Shabaab attacks are the people of the country.
Who were these victims? Somali people who are recovering from the attacks 5 years ago in the same area. Some of them recovered from injuries, some were disabled, some were orphans who lost their loved relatives in previous attacks, and others.
Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia are getting bolder in their attacks that are specifically designed to inflict massive civilian casualties. This Takfiri terrorist group has also increased sophisticated attacks across Somalia over the last few years. And questions are being raised over who is really funding this Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group.
Al-Shabaab has benefited from several sources of income over the years, including other terrorist groups. You mentioned Al-Qaeda. They also receive income from piracy, from kidnapping, and extortion of local businesses, farmers, and aid groups. You know, it's really built up an extensive racketeering operation with checkpoint taxation on illicitly traded charcoal, which Somalia has an abundance of, that brings in millions of dollars per year for Al-Shabaab, despite a UN ban on Somali charcoal exports. And that ban has been in place since 2012. The group also profits from smuggling contraband sugar across the Kenyan border, which is a scheme that Kenyan forces have been accused of involvement in. And the United Nations said that in 2019, Al-Shabaab spent upward of $21 million on fighters, weapons, and intelligence, and that the group was enjoying sizable budgetary surpluses. So, I mean, it's not very clear where all of that money is coming from, but we know of a few sources.
The reintroduction of the United States military is seen as another effort on the part of Washington
to reassert its imperialistic presence in the energy-rich and strategic Horn of Africa region.
The then Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby, who is the current coordinator for strategic communications at the National Security Council in the White House, announced in May that President Joe Biden authorized the return of U.S. military presence in Somalia following a drawdown of troops in the final days of the Trump administration.
I can announce today that the president has authorized the Department of Defense to return a small, persistent U.S. military presence to Somalia. This decision was based on a request from Secretary Austin and included advice from senior commanders and, of course, concern for the safety of our troops who have incurred additional risk by deploying in and out of Somalia on an episodic basis for the past.
Mr. Osazua earlier mentioned drone attacks carried out by the U.S. in Somalia. Now, Washington claims the drone strikes are targeting Al-Shabaab terrorists. But the more the U.S. makes this claim, the more Al-Shabaab carries out deadlier attacks on Somalis. So what is the U.S. really doing in Somalia?
The U.S. is in Somalia to use U.S. military power to impose U.S. control of Somali land, resources, and labor to service the needs of multinational corporations and the wealthy. So, U.S. and African leaders say that they're, in Somalia to fight terrorism. But, while AFRICOM has been in existence, the military command that's been tasked with carrying that fight barbarity and these drone strikes and terrorist attacks have only increased ninefold, right? And so the real reason we understand for U.S. presence is to protect U.S. neocolonial interests. Somalia has a very promising petroleum industry that is largely untapped. They call it one of the last truly unexplored oil frontiers, and many major oil firms are keen to profit there, including like Shell and ExxonMobil.
Somalia is currently facing one of its worst droughts in decades. The situation is projected to intensify as the country faces the risk of a fifth consecutive failed rainy season from October to December 2022. A Somali affected by drought elaborates here on the dire situation in the country. The terrorist attacks in Somalia are impacting on the country's current drought crisis, which is threatening the lives of millions.
Somalia is suffering one of the worst droughts in a generation. After many successive poor rainy seasons and harvests, the food shortage has reached crisis proportions in the country, and there's an unrelenting surge in food prices that are fueling inflation. And according to the UN, the drought is leaving something like 4.6 million people without enough food. So just a lot of food insecurity. And, people are recalling the horror of the 2011-2012 famine, right, where the death toll was staggering. They said an estimated 258,000 people lost their lives during that period, and half of those who died were children. And we understand that nature isn't the main culprit for Somalia's famine, right? There's this war, this drone war, the terrorism, or the conflict that is really driving a lot of the suffering.
The African Union, United Nations, and Somali government decided in April that the African Transition Mission in Somalia will operate in the country until the end of 2024, after which all responsibilities will be handed to the Somali security forces. A Somali government official says the Mogadishu government has commenced plans to implement the transition plan.
Somalia has commenced the revision of the Somalia Transition Plan to ensure that our vision, strategic objectives, and priorities are aligned with the transnational nature of the threats that we face today. The revised Somali Transition Plan, along with the joint CONOPS, paves the way for the Somali security forces to lead more offensive operations built around agile, mobile, and resilient forces.
Now, African Union troops will leave Somalia by the end of 2024. Do you think the Somali government is on the right track to take over security responsibility?
the formation of the African Union Mission to Somalia, or AMISOM, in 2007 has served the interests of successive U.S. and Western European administrations, and funding for that mission has been provided by the U.S. and other NATO countries, along with the United Nations. Every year, the presence of AMISOM has been renewed by the UN, although in 2022, the operation was reconfigured in order to further carry out its military mission.
President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, who took office in May, faces many challenges from Al-Shabaab terrorists and a drought threatening millions of Somalis. Many in Somalia and the region are wondering if peace will ever return in the country. Now, what will it take to restore security and stability in Somalia?
The U.S. and NATO that have created the conditions for and fueled the current conflict. So removing the U.S., NATO forces and their proxies from the country can only allow for people-centered, participatory, democratic solutions to come to the fore to address the current conflict and drought crisis. I'm in favor of, you know, working towards the development of a radical type of peace, right? And that radical type of peace is one that isn't solely about the absence of conflict, but, you know, achievement through popular struggle and self-defense of, you know, liberation from these issues of unjust war and subversion.
Well, there you have it. Colonial powers led by the United States are the real reason behind the dire situation in Somalia. I would like to thank our guest, Tunde Osazwa, of the Black Alliance for Peace, for his incisive analysis. And we now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the rising poverty among children in Africa.
Poverty afflicting African children.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
More than 150 million children across East and Southern Africa are gripped by grinding poverty and climate disaster. Now, this is according to a recent report by the charity organization Save the Children.
The report noted that South Sudan topped the list of countries in East and Southern Africa most likely to face the Dabo threat, with 87% of the country's children affected, followed by Mozambique with 80%, while 73% of the children in Madagascar have been affected.
The executive director of African Child Policy Forum says climate change is reversing progress made over the recent years by African countries.
For a long time, Africa was making progress in terms of addressing malnutrition, but now we are going back and we're seeing child hunger is increasing. Food insecurity has become a problem. Because of that, food prices have gone up. Living costs have gone up. So African children are not having the basic 3 meals a day. They're undernourished. They're not getting the basic elements of nutrition that they need.
Well, for more on the state of African children facing poverty, we have contacted Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist. Thank you for joining us today. Now, what's your take on the rising poverty among children in Africa, and what are the main factors behind this sad state of affairs?
The rising figure and state of poverty among children as one of the vulnerable segments of the population in Africa is very concerning, because we are talking about the youngest continent, which is Africa, with whose members, who make up almost 60% of its population, are poor, are vulnerable, are in form of destitution. Now, that is very worrying, especially when you are looking at promoting inclusive development, ensuring that the aspirations of the African Agenda 2063 are realized.
Half of Africa's population is under the age of 20, and according to the Children's Climate Risk Index, 490 million children in 35 sub-Saharan countries are at risk from the worst impacts of climate change. African children are bearing the brunt of climate change, yet African countries have the least contribution to the climate change crisis. One of the paradoxes of the climate crisis is that former colonial powers that are primarily responsible for climate change are relatively better insulated from the impact. On the other hand, Africans, especially innocent children who have made the least contribution to the crisis, suffer the most. For instance, more than 1 million people in southern Madagascar are struggling to get enough to eat due to what experts say is the first famine caused by climate change.
Now, what is the link between colonialism or neocolonialism and the current levels of poverty among children in Africa?
Colonial Africa produce was inserted into the global economy on uneven terms as supplier of raw materials, in other words, primary commodity dependence, defined Africa's position in the global economy. This has not changed. The unfortunate bit is that raw commodity dependence traps you at the level where you are only earning peanuts. Now, Africa is largely predominantly an agrarian economy. Agriculture is no longer one of the biggest sectors that are driving the economy. Now, again, with unfair terms of trade, where Africa remains the supplier of, for example, take an example of cocoa. The chocolate industry, which is almost $100 billion, brings to Ghana and Ivory Coast, who contribute almost 80% of the world's cocoa. It only brings to them $2 billion. In other words, that is $98 billion is retained in economies of the West, former colonial masters that have harnessed the capacity of manufacturing chocolate and continue defending and continue ensuring supply of cocoa, unhindered supply of cocoa through trade agreement.
Western powers claim to be at the forefront of championing human rights, including the rights of children, but have contributed the most to the suffering of African children. Now, neocolonial powers looted Africa during the colonial era and are still continuing the pillage while igniting the climate crisis.
In terms of human rights, I think we are seeing a manifestation of what I call double standards and rigged rules. Human rights, as it is one of the buzzwords that has become catchy in development narratives, it is actually not one of the core interests of the global, nor of the Western powers, because they are one of the biggest violators of these same rights. Take an example of COVID-19. We saw the Western powers hoarding drugs.
Child rights campaigners are warning that the climate crisis in Africa undermines the rights of children to life, health, education, and security. All this while the risks of violence, exploitation, and displacement increase.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what immediate measures should be taken to alleviate the suffering of African children?
There are largely internal measures that African countries need to take to ensure that they alleviate poverty and the suffering of our children. One of those is, for example, to ensure access to high quality free education, ensure access to affordable and free quality health. All these are sectors that have been monetized, been largely privatized, and it is all becoming harder and harder for the poor families of the children to be able to afford these services. Now, that is something that needs to change. Two, financing of our own development agenda is critical if Africa is to address the development challenges.
Well, our guest there says for the suffering of African children to end, Africa must fund its own development agenda and neocolonial powers must stop looting the continent. Thank you very much, Africa Kiiza, for your insight today. That brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the book Nahjul Balagha. Sayyid al-Razi, one of the outstanding Muslim Shia scholars and prolific writers, has compiled this book and has collected the sermons, letters, and aphorisms of Imam Ali alayhi salam in a book called Nahjul Balagha, or The Peak of Eloquence. Nowadays, in the shelves of the Muslims, two important books are beside the Holy Quran, Nahjul Balagha, and we can say Mafatih al-Jalam by Sheikh Abbas al-Ghumi, and also we can say Saifat al-Sajadiyya by Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. Why Nahjul Balagha has reached such a great position that is put beside the Quran on the shelves of the libraries of the Muslims, especially the Shia ones? And up to an extent, it's reached up higher status, up to an extent that it is called Akhul Quran, I mean, the brother of the Holy Quran. Why is it so?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the title Brother of Quran or Akhul Quran is not mentioned in the narrations of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. It has been given to Nahj al-Balagha as by some of the great Shia scholars. And we cannot attribute it to the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. This is mentioned by some of the Shia scholars to show the greatness and the importance of this book, like the title of Ukhtul Quran, which is somehow called, which is used to refer to Sahifa Sajjadiyya, the sister of the Quran.
Yes.
So it doesn't mean that, they are like the Noble Book of Quran, just they wanted to show the greatness of these two books. So anyway, this is the viewpoint of some scholars. Some people might claim that, okay, we do not like this title.
Yes.
Because no human word can be compared to the word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
But anyway, as I mentioned, it's a matter of different viewpoints. Whether
and for sure it is for showing the great status of these
exactly,
two books.
It's a kind of metaphor.
Yes,
I mean, no one, even these scholars, do not, no one believe has claimed that, Nahj al-Balagha can be compared to the Noble Book of Quran. Now, what is the reason? The point is that this is for sure that after the Noble Book of Quran, no other book can be compared to Nahj al-Balagha. And this can be seen through different facts. The way the Muslims, of course, especially the Shia, they have highly regarded Nahj al-Balagha. When it comes to Persian translation, we may have more than 40 translations available for Nahj al-Balagha, and nowadays, alhamdulillah, for many languages. There are so many commentaries written for Nahj al-Balagha. According to some scholars, we have maybe more than 400 books.
Yes.
Other kind of commentary regarding the Noble Book of regarding Nahj al-Balagha.
Research institutes are also established
exactly
for studying Nahj al-Balagha. Okay.
One of the main reasons that people both Shia, the Muslims, and even non-Muslims, I will come to some examples from non-Muslims, they have highly regarded Nahj al-Balagha is because of the literary significance of the book. I'm talking about Fasaha and Balagha, the rhetoric and the
eloquence
of this book. So, for example, Ibn Abil Hadid, who is one of the great Sunni scholars, but he has written a great commentary on Nahj al-Balagha, he says that one line of Nahj al-Balagha is like 1,000 lines of the words of Ibn Nabata, who was a very, very famous lecturer and orator in the 4th century after Hijra.
That's right.
And now let's quote a Christian Lebanese scholar, the famous name George Ordaq, who also calls Nahj al-Balagha a book which utmost level of eloquence. And also he calls Nahj al-Balagha, Quran in a lower level.
Yes, yes, compiled the famous book Al-Imam Ali Sawt al-Adalat
al-Insaniyah. And according to Alusi, it's been mentioned that he is quoted as saying that there are some words in Nahj al-Balagha which are very close to being a miracle. Mm-hmm. And that is why some people, they have introduced Nahj al-Balagha as ma fawq al-makhluq ma dun al-khaliq, meaning that the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha are below the word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Noble Book of Quran, but higher than the word of any human being.
Yes.
So, or for example, kalamuhu duna kalam al-khaliq wa fawqa kalam al-makhluq.
Yes.
So all these points refer to the reason why some great Shia scholars have tried to show this greatness and significance by calling the Noble Book of Quran as Akhul Quran, or the somehow brother of the Quran in a metaphorical way.
That's all right.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah.
In order to be more familiar with, we can say, Nahjul Balagha, there is another famous book called Nahjul Saada, Fi Musaddaq al-Nahjul Balagha, written by Allama Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi. Really an outstanding work. Some of the missed parts of Sayyid al-Razi are also mentioned in that book. It is written in Arabic language. It has a nice preface to the eloquence, as you said, and the rhetoric of Nahjul Balagha.
One important point that sometimes some people who read Nahjul Balagha are not aware of is that the main purpose of Sayyid al-Razi was just to collect the sermons, letters, and short sayings, which were great in Arabic eloquence.
Yes.
So that's why in some cases Sayyid al-Razi had not quoted the full letter or the full text of the sermon. No, he just has chosen some parts which were greater in eloquence and has not quoted the remaining parts. And that is why many other books have been written to complete this task of Nahjul Balagha and this task of Sayyid al-Razi, including Nahjul Saada that you mentioned.
Yes.
I said that many people who read, but unfortunately many people do not read. According to Nahjul Balagha, according to some statistic, maybe less than 5% of even Shia,
the people,
they have read Nahjul Balagha once in their lifetime.
Or the Muslim communities are not familiar with it.
Non-Shia,
they have never heard of it, you know, what is the book Nahjul Balagha. I myself have, we can say, talked to some of our Sunni brethren, whether you know the book Nahjul Balagha or not. They have not heard even the title.
That's very unfortunate. And as I mentioned, when it comes to George Dog, a Christian scholar, he says that I've read Nahjul Balagha more than 200 times. This is very astonishing. And he has dedicated 40 years to read about Imam Ali alayhi salam and about his book Nahjul Balagha. And his famous book, as you mentioned, is Imam al-Hadith, Sawt al-Adarat al-Insaniya. And it's been mentioned that, I have not seen the page, but it's been mentioned that on the back cover of the book, Imam al-Hadith, Sawt al-Adarat al-Insaniya, this Christian scholar has written the following: O Ali, if I called you higher than Jesus, then my religion does not accept that. Meaning that as a Christian, I cannot call you higher than Jesus. If I say that Jesus is greater and higher than you, then my conscience does not accept, because I have read about you.
Yes.
I do not call you God, then, O Ali, you yourself tell me who you are. This is how a Christian scholar highly regard Imam Ali alayhi salam and his book Nahjul Balagha. One of the contemporary Shia scholars, Sheikh Dashti, who passed away a few years ago, and he has translated Nahjul Balagha in Persian language, in his introduction to the book says that I read one of the books or writings of George Dagh in the scholar that we are talking about, who said that the attraction of the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam brought me motivated me to read Nahjul Balagha 200 times. And then Sheikh Dashti says that then I was so much touched by this saying, because I regretted a lot that a Christian scholar has studied Nahjul Balagha for 200 times. And the question now for me and for many other Shia is that, are we familiar with Nahjul Balagha as this Christian scholar is? So I think you also rightly mentioned that when it comes to non-Shi'as, maybe the great majority of the Shi'a are not aware of the existence of such a book.
Yes.
And this is a very big duty of the Shi'a scholars, Shi'a communities, to at least introduce the book to non-Shi'as, to all Muslims, and not only the Muslims. There are some points in Nahjul Balagha which can be taken as lessons for all the people.
Yes.
There is a famous saying for Imam Ali alayhi salam, and this is a very famous one, that, honor the people because they are either your brother in faith or your brother or like you in creation.
Yes.
So,
this was the letter to Malik al-Ashtar, I think, when he was